Radio EcoShock.
I know, the world seems to be on fire right now, with a one-man tornado who can pay attention to anything. But suppose, in this riveting human drama, the natural world goes bad. Suppose there was a way to measure that, to really know about changes that affect our lives. That would be science. But even there, we can discover some wrong assumptions and strange new truths. For climate change, the root is carbon dioxide. But understanding global carbon is not easy. Fortunately, we have as our guide a world-recognized scientist. Dr. Josep Canadell is Executive Director of the Global Carbon Project and Chief Research Scientist at Australia's premier research institute, CSIRO. Known to all as PEP, Dr. Canadell is author of more than 240 peer-reviewed science papers. From Canberra, Australia, PEP Canadell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock. So you have a perspective article in the latest issue of Science. It's called Looking Beyond the Trees for Carbon Storage, and that accompanies a new study from Yinon M. Baron from the California Institute of Technology. And his new paper, it's titled Recent Gains in Global Terrestrial Carbon Stocks Are Mostly Stored in Non-Living Pools. Well, that doesn't sound very exciting, but it provides new visions of where carbon is stored, and that really matters. What drew you to this paper?
I think that this paper kind of brings a big surprise insofar that we have always thought that the extra carbon accumulated by vegetation due to the increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide is accumulated largely in what we call living biomass, that the trees are bigger, the trunks are bigger, that there's more roots, and ultimately also more litter and soil organic matter. And what the authors find is that the place where the least amount of carbon is accumulated is actually in the actual biomass, the trunks, the trees, the leaves. And instead, carbon flows through this vegetation very quickly into litter and into the soils. And from there, either accumulating the soils or being, you know, washed off into the inland waters, where, you know, all the lakes and rivers and ponds, everything that, you know, there's fresh water gets accumulated. And also they make the point that, of course, we take a lot of this biomass and we use it. We use it for wood construction of houses. We also put a lot of these woody materials ultimately into landfills. So basically, when they count everything, they find that only a few percentages of the total carbon sink that gets accumulated elsewhere, somewhere in the biosphere, stays in the living biomass, and the rest kind of goes into all these other pools, which we thought before were less important.
You know, even with your article and the paper, I was still a little lost until I took myself back to school to learn the basics. Carbon can be in the air, like carbon dioxide. It can be in the sea, but there is carbon, a lot of it, stored under our feet. Please tell us about the different forms of carbon found in the soil and why they matter.
Yeah, the soil carbon is a huge reservoir of carbon for various reasons, but one is that, you know, we have all the living biomass eventually dies and decomposes, and we have what we call organic carbon, which kind of stays in the soil, and then there's another fractions which are called inorganic carbon. But then we have all the what we call the very organic soils, the peats, you know, the big forests in Indonesia, in Congo, the wetlands, which have huge amounts of stored organic carbon. It's dead carbon already, but it still remains as organic. And when we look at how much there is in all these places, we have many times more carbon stored in the soil, what we call in the permafrost, you know, frozen organic soils of the northern latitudes, Canada, Russia. We have, you know, several times more than the accumulated carbon in the atmosphere. So the atmosphere has about a little more than 800 billion tons of carbon. And in the soils and organic soils and peatlands and permafrost, you know, we have at least three times that quantity stored there.
In your perspective in science, you also point out wildfires released unprecedented surges of CO2 emissions in Siberia in 2021 and in Canada in 2023. Do you think those events can accelerate climate change?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. So we have many different types of fires around the world. Think for a second, Australian fires, 2019, we had humongous, unprecedented amount of forest fires. But our vegetation in Australia is actually highly adapted to fire, and those forests have recovered literally in a matter of very few years, almost to the point they were before the fires. Now, this thing might not go forever, but that's what's happening now. Now, go to what we call the boreal forest in Canada, in Siberia, where when you burn a forest, it takes literally many decades to more than 100 years to bring all that carbon back. The reasons being twofold. First is because a lot of those trees, species, are not adapted to fire necessarily, and they may not have the kind of resprouting capacity that other species around the world might have, number one. And number two, the soils, which often are very organic, has a lot of organic matter. And when you burn that organic matter, you're burning dozens of years of accumulation of carbon that is going to take those dozens of years up to more than 100 years to accumulate again once the forest gets reestablished. So that huge imbalance means carbon will remain in the atmosphere for a long time and will increase the overall carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and therefore the warming impact of that carbon dioxide.
And there's a lot of life under the ground. I mean, there's 60 billion tiny worms, the nematodes, for every human on the planet. My question is, if the living plants are less important, perhaps, than the organic carbon in the soil, here's what we really need to know. Has microbic life that breaks down carbon in the soil and releases it, has it increased with warming, thus speeding up the release of that carbon? Do we know?
We don't. We know that there's a lot of carbon on microbial organisms, a lot, but we don't know it as well as being able to track any changes over time as we could and as we can, let's say, for Abu Ghraib biomass, which we now have satellites, as in the study we're discussing, satellites that they can track those changes annually, sometimes even monthly. So we don't have that capacity to do it. Now, all these organisms are important, and they're all impacted by climate change. And, of course, microbial communities are heavily impacted by changes in rainfall, which means soil moisture. Of course, a wetter, more moist soils are better for these microbial flora to excel. And also temperature. They all work better when the soils are warmer. And the one thing that we know for sure that's happening with climate change is that both air and soils and oceans are all warming up.
And the balance of carbon going into or out of our soil seems to have changed since the 1990s. Global plant capture goes up and down. How would you explain that?
Yeah, so plants are, we're talking about the you know, how much carbon is absorbed by plants. The ocean also absorbs carbon dioxide, but, you know, the studies about plants and particularly woody plants, mostly forests. And these forest species are, of course, very sensitive to weather and climate changes. And so what we find is that when we have some of these events, global climatic events, let's say what we call the Southern Oscillation, the El Niño and La Niña, during El Niño years, globally, the mean temperature is actually warmer than the average. And when we have La Niñas, again, these are almost global phenomena, the global mean temperature is cooler than the average. And so every time that there is one of these phenomena, plants react to it. And so when there is a warmer world during an El Niño, plants take up less carbon dioxide. And we have actually measured and estimated and studied this thing very well. The same way, when we have a La Niña, we have more carbon dioxide being uptaken by the plants, which is a good thing. The problem is that as we move into the future in a global warming world, we know the direction of the efficiency of these carbon sinks, which is to become less efficient because we know that they operate less well under warmer conditions. So that's not a good outcome, or that's not a good outlook for us. As nature, as we move into the future, will bring less support to what it is now, about the removal of about half of all CO2 emissions from human activities. That is, every year we put about 11 billion tons of carbon from human activities, from combustion of fossil fuels to deforestation. And about half of these 11 billion tons are absorbed by plants, vegetation, and the ocean. So what I'm trying to get here to is that as we move into the future, this fraction of, 50% of all CO2 being removed will diminish. So we have now like a 50% discount of climate change thanks to nature. So this nature in the future will help us a little less, which is a very compelling rationale for us to act as quickly and as fast as we can, because it is now that we have this, very high level of support from nature to kind of slow down the buildup of CO2 and therefore warming.
Is there a bit of good news in this new way of understanding carbon in the soil from this study?
Yes. So by having more carbon accumulated from these carbon sinks that we're discussing, accumulated in outside of vegetation, it means that what has been a store perhaps is a little more stable than what we thought before, because now, that carbon store, it's not in the vegetation, it's not in the leaves, it's not in the branches, it's not in the trunk. So if these were to burn, of course, we're losing a lot of carbon, but we have a lot of this carbon that is stored under lakes, being pushed down to the coastal areas and buried in sediments. We have them also in human reservoirs, in landfills, for good or for bad, and in our ever building and expanding urban world, with, more wood requirements for, from furniture to actually building the actual houses. So, that's a good part of, this new study, but nevertheless, carbon has to go through vegetation first before it gets accumulated in all these other stores. And of course, that process, it's still susceptible to droughts and extreme warming, and extreme heats and fire. And, we see also the growth in many parts of temperate to boreal regions of more insect damage because the winters are warmer than they used to be. So, these things are still vulnerable. The process is still vulnerable to all these processes. But what has accumulated already is perhaps a little more stable than what we thought. And that's a good thing.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and with us is Dr. Pep Cannadel, Chief Research Scientist at CISRO. And we are learning there is much more carbon stored in the soil than in the plants above. Back in 2011, I interviewed a Vermont carbon farmer, Abe Collins. He was part of the Soil Carbon Challenge, along with Peter Donovan. They attempted to get carbon farming recognized in the New England carbon trading scheme at the time, and then it seemed like tree planting became a more popular solution. With this new study, were these carbon farming folks onto something?
Yeah, so let me just maybe begin by saying that the biggest issue of soil carbon, and in this case of your example, above ground tree carbon, is what we call the verification. It is relatively easy for us to have a project and go and measure how much carbon we have in the trees. We can go there and measure the diameters of the trunks and the height of the trees. And we can see this thing over time, how it changes. So now if we have bigger projects, we have even satellites that begin to measure these things and every time are more reliable. When we go to the soils, we can do good measures of carbon in the soil. We do, actually, with the techniques are very well established, but it is a little harder for us to measure how that pool that had carbon in the soil changes over time. And the reason is that there's so much carbon in the soil that, of course, the changes are going to be obviously very small and therefore difficult to detect. And that's why a lot of programs have basically either ignore the soil or just not go there at all. And some they just stayed with, you know, trees that people feel that they can see and they can measure whether they're there, or they're not, whether they're growing or they're not growing or whether they're burning. So that's the main reason. Now, are we onto something new because the study? Well, the study emphasized that, you know, ultimately a more important reservoir of this new carbon entering into the system is the soil than the actual trees and trunks. And maybe we'll give a bit of an impetus. The verification and measurement thing remains an issue, but there's new technologies as well. There's more kind of a spectroscopy technologies that are making it a little easier to measure hundreds to thousands of samples of soil for carbon. And maybe some of these technologies will help to give the confidence to investors and people running these programs or trying to establish these programs to include soil carbon.
I'm sure you recall the conference, 4 degrees or More, Australia in a Hot World, back in 2011. And when you and I talked in 2018, we dared to ask, is even 2 degrees C of warming just a dream now? And just recently, the government of France announced they were planning adaptation for 4 degrees C of warming. Is it just me, or is it madness to think that this civilization would survive well in a world that is 4 degrees hotter global mean temperature?
Well, I think that is madness to think that we would survive. There'll be survival, of course, but things will be very, very different. I must say that with everything that is happening, for good and for bad, we don't think that we're moving into a 4 degree world. I mean, a 4 degree world, as it has been modeled by these scenarios that we develop in the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they rely on a future all the way to 2100, where almost the entire economy will be based on coal energy. So the coal would be gasified to produce gas, it would be liquefied to produce liquid fuels that we need for cars. It would be everything. And clearly we're not going so incredibly dirty anymore. If anything, coal power plants are clearly, you know, to begin with, not financially competitive with any other of the current technologies. And we see a huge slowdown. And in countries like, of course, the US, many parts of Europe, including Australia as well, we have huge, very rapidly closure of coal power plants. So I don't think we're going to this 4 degree world. Now, have we missed even the opportunity to stay under 2 degrees? Well, that's up in the air. I don't think that we know. A lot of people are confident that we still can do it. And I think that we can still do it, but certainly we cannot be sleeping on the wheel, as it seems we are doing, you know, sometimes going back and forth in case here is, of course, the U.S. at this point. But, you know, we really have to actually become much more aggressive on a path now that we understand very well, where, you know, coal, you know, almost disappears completely. Gas plays a role that it's highly debated. You know, we try to electrify the economy, you know, almost as much as we can, and things that we had not even thought they were possible. Now we know that they're possible. And of course, if we can produce that electricity with renewable, low carbon, energies, then we are in the path. But that aggressiveness that we need to push this process, it's not there yet. And 2 degrees can very quickly, you know, slip off our hands as well.
I do notice that at the Mauna Loa Observatory in 2024, CO2 increased by 3.58 parts per million in the air. And that's the biggest jump ever recorded. It's something like 25% higher than 2023. The EU's Copernicus system reports a lower number, an increase of 2.9 parts per million in 2024. Either way, carbon is climbing faster than ever. Your group at the Global Carbon Project has to take all this in kind of on the run. What does the acceleration, if there is one, mean for a carbon budget for governments?
Yeah, so first of all, it's very difficult to say whether it's an acceleration because, you know, the Earth system is a very complex system. It has all these variability, and we try not to make our statements out of a few years' data. Having said that, you know, we might be waiting for something to be confirmed from a science point of view and then be way too late to do anything about it. So I think we need to be really on top of these annual updates. Yes, 2024 was extraordinary. 2023 was also quite extraordinary. And not only Mauna Loa and Copernicus, here in Australia, we also measure, you know, atmospheric CO2, and we saw a huge jump as well. Now, what it means that the natural CO2 sinks, the very things we were talking about a second ago on the vegetation, the forest, you know, the grasslands of the world. And in this case, also, I need to bring the oceans because warmer oceans are less efficient at, you know, absorbing CO2. It means that they're working less well. The efficiency of these natural CO2 sinks, which I said before, they're removing 50% of all our emissions. Our emissions means active, you know, from human activities, combustion of fossil fuels and deforestation, you know, will become less and less uptake and therefore more and more carbon left into the atmosphere. Therefore, faster warming and what we call the remaining carbon budget, which is your question, of course, shrinks even faster than the emissions that humans are putting into it, because now we have this ally that we had before, nature, helping us a little less. And that's what exactly we're seeing in 2024 with a big spike of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, which does not mean that we emitted, humans emitted much more carbon dioxide. No, we did not. We continue to emit huge amounts, 10 billion tons of carbon, which is an insane amount of carbon, but it is the natural sinks that they did less good, they did less well, and therefore the total amount of our emissions that stayed in the atmosphere were much, much higher. In this case, a record, you know, in the observatory record that we have.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Australia's David Karoly, and we discussed the wanton destruction of American science and whether the rest of the world could step up to keep the essential climate research going. With your role at CISRO and the Global Carbon Project, Pep, you are part of that rest of the world, in my mind. What are the challenges for climate science now?
Well, first of all, we need to kind of wait and see what's happening. Well, wait and see. We need to make a bigger investment ourselves, the rest of the world, as you put it. But we need to wait and see, you know, whether we're truly looking at the discontinuation of some of the observations and big data sets and long-term data sets that NOAA and NASA, you know, are responsible for. They could come to a termination, and it would have, you know, really important impacts. The contribution of global networks from NOAA and NASA are disproportionately large, so, which means that if any of those data sets and observations were to stop, we would have a huge hole, which would take us many, many years to try to fill. And of course, we would lose, you know, the continuity, which is one of the most important things, to continue with a historical period so we can analyze very carefully, you know, the changes into present and then, you know, what's to come in the future. We're waiting and see just to see what the ultimate impact is above and beyond, and many people losing important positions of research positions and observatory positions in these agencies. We're all very concerned about the near future.
Pep Cannadale, you have big desks in Australian research and global carbon. What are your priorities coming up?
Well, we're trying to put a lot of emphasis on other gases. We're focused on methane and nitrous oxide. Methane maybe has had a bit of a more of an interest as before. It was kind of almost a secondary gas. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. We have an opportunity to really try to lower, you know, what we call the peak warming. One thing is stabilizing the climate, which we need zero emissions from carbon dioxide. But the other thing is that at which point, at which peak we're stabilizing warming. And methane can play a very important role at really bringing that peak down so that we can truly avoid 2 degrees and kind of bring the overall effort with CO2 more under control. Nitrous oxide comes mostly from cropping using nitrogen fertilizers, chemical fertilizers. Of course, we use millions and millions of tons of these every year to produce food. It's a very difficult place to go because this is food security. You know, we try to keep it, you know, as a top priority of every single country, but it is an important contributor. It's the third most important gas, nitrous oxide. And so we try to also emphasize a little more what the opportunities are to bring those emissions down. And finally, we're continue to be very focused on, you know, trying to develop very sophisticated, complex, what we call full comprehensive budgets of greenhouse gases at the regional and national level, so that we can actually support governments and actors in each country around the world to understand where the sources, where the sinks, which are natural, which are anthropogenic, which are changing because human behavior, which ones are changing because we're changing the climate itself. And that kind of feeds back into some of those natural sources and sinks of greenhouse gases. So we can have a very comprehensive picture, and that can help to plan a little better, you know, the actions for rapid mitigation.
Well, as we end our time together, I want to say that many of our listeners are really worried about climate change. This comes out in polls. It comes out in a lot of ways. Is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I think that the response to climate change, which is basically decarbonizing, it is actually something very desirable. I mean, one could argue that you want to decarbonize even if there is no climate change, because what we're trying to do is to move away from highly polluting energies. Coal is incredibly polluting. It's responsible for thousands of deaths, premature deaths every year. We have natural gas even in our houses, inside of our houses, and we know that. There's nitrous oxides, there's other organic particulate components that come from that combustion, even on our stoves, which are, you know, from a health point of view, are something that we don't want, and we have even inside of our house. We're trying to develop much more sophisticated, you know, modes of transportation. Certainly, if anyone has ever driven an electric car, I doubt that we'll ever go back to an internal combustion car, because it's such a thing much more sophisticated. At the same time, it's much easier to produce, to run, much more efficient in terms of the use of the energy. Internal combustion cars, they you know, waste at least half of the energy embedded into the gasoline we're using. So in a way, we're trying to create a little, I would call it a better world. There's no doubt about it. Renewable energy can be domestically grown. So we don't have to have all these big geopolitical, you know, mess that we had for many decades. So, you know, one thing after the other that we need to do for a rapid decarbonization are things that, as I said, we probably want to have anyway. So it's a win-win. That's what I'm trying to say. And therefore, really worth pushing as hard as we can. And now more than ever before, we actually know mostly how to do, maybe not 100% everything we need to do, but probably 90% of what we need to do to decarbonize that economy, the energy systems. Something that we didn't know, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we were still discussing, are cars going to be fueled by biofuels? Are they going to be fueled by hydrogen? Are going to be electric? And now it clearly, you know, electric is what it seems clear the choice, an economic choice, which is reasonable. We know how to do it. We can deploy it fast. You know, hydrogen might play some role. Biofuels might play some role, but these are all secondary roles. These things we did not know clearly, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So it's exciting to see how the path to decarbonization, to low carbon emissions, is coming very clear, very quickly.
From Australia's capital, Canberra, we've been speaking with Dr. Pep Canadel. You can find links to his new article, Looking Beyond the Trees for Carbon Storage, and the new study on global carbon stocks, all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Pep, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.